Welcome to our new series of readings. I brought a stack of the semester announcements. If you didn't receive them, there's a stack out on the refreshment table in the hall. Now, I know you can all read, but I fear that you may look at the announcement and see what you expect instead of what's on there. Howard Moss is reading for us next week, and his reading will be on Monday night instead of our usual Wednesday night. And instead of being here, it will be in the Harville Auditorium. So that's next Monday, the 4th. Harville Auditorium is at the corner of Olive and Sand, that big new classroom building, and the auditorium is on the western side of the building. You have to go down a dark, long tunnel to get to it. Also, Mr. Moss will be meeting with all interested individuals the following day, Tuesday the 5th, in the Student Union, room 256 at 3 in the afternoon. There's another reading next week on Wednesday night in this auditorium. Wednesday night in the Terrace Lounge in the Student Union. It's the first reading in the series that will be sponsored by Writers at Work. And the readers are Allison Hicks, who's a Master of Fine Arts candidate at the university, and Stephen Schwartz, who's a former university student, and that will be a fiction reading. I hope you can stay after the reading tonight and have some refreshments, and me and Silken will be right out in the hall. Also, we will have some of Mr. Silken's books available for sale tonight. I'm very happy that John Silken could finally come. Our correspondence dates back to 1971, so it's taken us a long time to get him here. His most recent book, from Rutledge and Kegan Paul in 1980, is his Selected Poems. In addition to poetry, he has written Out of Battle, a critical study of First World War poets. He edited the Penguin Book of First World War Poetry. For the last 20 years, he's lived in Newcastle upon Tyne, where he edits magazine Stand. Stand was founded by Mr. Silken in 1952. And as you know, in the American literary world, so many really fine poetry magazines come and go before you can ever get your subscription sent out. To have a magazine which has been in continuous publication for 32 years is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I'm very happy to introduce to you John Silken.
My first book was a book called The Peaceable Kingdom, which is a title that doesn't mean much to English readers, but I think perhaps means something to you. It's the title of something like 60 versions of a painting that the American so-called primitive Quaker artist Edward Hicks did in his adult lifetime. And what Hicks is depicting is that part of Isaiah where the wolf and the lamb and the lion will lie down together and the little child will need it. And it's an image of an ideal harmonious society such as Hicks certainly didn't have. He died 11 years before your Civil War. And clearly such as we don't have now, or perhaps I could put it in a different way and say such as Isaiah didn't enjoy either. That brings me to, in a way, the nature of the kind of ideology that I think that first book pursued, and which I think I've continued to pursue. I am a Jew, and we have a joke about the meaning of the word Messiah. You've had yours, but we're still waiting for ours. But the meaning of the word Messiah, according to the Jews, is never. Well, it's not much of a joke, I realize that, but the spirit, yes. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is very unwilling. Also, crib the title from Mr. Hicks, because Nearly all the animals, nearly all the poems in my first book have animals as their central figures. They're in the position not of victims, not of martyrs, but of victims. I think what I'm trying to say is that the martyr chooses his or her suffering, but the victim does not choose. The victim is handed out. And that's more or less the condition of the animals in my poems. In this first book, certainly. But I'll read one or two from that collection. This is... When I came out of the army in 1950, I decided that I would become a laborer, because being brought up as a middle-class gentleman, I realized after serving in the army as a national serviceman that I knew nothing whatsoever about the way in which most people subsisted and earned their livings, and about the urban working class in Britain. And so I decided that there was one way to educate myself, and that was to actually become a labourer, which I did. And in those days, as now in England, under the kingdom of the thatch, as a labourer you can be hired and sacked very easily indeed, especially the sacking. And I was on my way to collect my dole money, and as I was leaving the apartment, the flat that I was living in London, in an area called Blackheath, there were two dogs outside, and I noticed that they were sort of lunging at something. One was our dog, one was the landlord's dog. They were little dogs, and they were lunging at something and then recoiling. And when I looked down, there was this dead black bird, and they wanted to take a lump out of it, but they didn't have the courage to do so, maybe because the bird was dead. Who knows? Anyhow, that was an interesting tableau, and when I, on my way to the labor exchange to collect my dole money, I wrote this poem on the top of London called Carved. Two small dogs stood by a dead black bird, and the black bird was very dead. The two dogs stood by the bird like large lions, but they never touched the dead thing once. They would like to have eaten the black thing, but it was very dead, with red ants sawing its neck away like stonemasons. And the red ants were very much alive. So all the time the dogs stood, they barked there, because they couldn't eat the black thing. Something large about that black bird. It was being eaten by red death, while the two large lion small dogs just stood, barking. They never touched the black thing. And the black thing never looked at them once. It was indifferent to two small dogs. Maybe it did not hear those large lions, or maybe the black bird felt sorry for the small dogs. Meanwhile, the dead went on being dead, and the living, living. This is a poem that the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was going to use as one of their poems for a flag day. But I guess they decided that poetry was not the best way to earn money or to raise money, so they didn't do it in the end. It's a poem called Caring for Animals. I mean, the argument, is not quite as naive, perhaps, as it looks. My argument is based on the sort of notion that if we could care for animals just moderately, we might come to care just a little more than moderately for the human animal. That may be wrong, but that was the supposition that the poem worked upon. I ask sometimes why these small animals with bitter eyes, why we should care for them. I question the sky, the serene blue water, but it cannot say, it gives no answer. And no answer releases in my head a procession of grey shades, patched and whimpering. Dogs with clipped ears, wheezing cart horses, a fly without shadow and without thought. Is it with these menaces to our vision, with this procession led by a man carrying wood, we must be concerned? The Holy Land, the rearing green island, should be kindlier than this. The animals, our ghosts, need tending to. Take in the whipped cat and the blinded owl. Take up the man-trapped squirrel upon your shoulder. Attend to the unnecessary beasts. From growing mercy and a moderate love, great love for the human animal occurs. And your love grows, your great love grows and grows. Well, so much for the peaceable kingdom. In 1958, I was lucky enough to get offered a fellowship, a non-academic fellowship, that was given to practicing poets at the University of Leeds. And that's, it was a marvelous thing, because I was, for the first time in my life, free of my adult life, free of worrying about money. And that was a fairly rare thing in England. Well, it still is fairly rare, that there are not all that number of fellowships going for people with no strings attached. Anyhow, I went to Leeds, and Leeds is a city that I came to like very much. It's got actually a 10% Jewish population, which I also liked. Those people who don't like that refer to Leeds as the New Jerusalem. That's their problem, I think. But close to the city of Leeds is a very different city, the city of York, which is, of course, the capital of Yorkshire, what was the largest county in Britain. And it's one of the ecclesiastical centres of the north of England. And that's important to the next poem I'd like to read, because in 1190, there was a massacre of the Jews in the city of York, quite a number of them. While Richard I was out trying to recover the Holy Land for Christendom, a number of cities used the absence of the king to destroy the Jews in Britain. 100 years later, the Jews were expelled from England because their resources as moneylenders had run out. The king borrowed but did not return. Neither the interest nor the capital. Well, some people don't like the interest, but the capital, well, I mean. Anyhow, they must have had very little money because quite a number of the Jews were dumped overboard mid-channel by the boatmen. Anyhow, well, that's a bit passé. Because the city of York appears to be a bit touchy about this. You know, the city of York has two industries. One is chocolates and the other is tourism. And the city of York, it issues a guidebook to its historic, I was going to say remains, but the remains are very substantial, actually. They're hardly ruins. And what they say is, they make a very coy reference. They say that the Jews of York perished in 1190 through anti-Jewish riotings. When you think that's a very tautological statement, and it is coy, it doesn't say very much, except that the Jews died because they were killed. Well, that is one way of dying, that's true. So, incensed by the reticence of the city fathers, I wrote this poem. It's a kind of Jewish Baedeker, I suppose. The poem is called The Coldness. Where the printing works buttress a church, and the northern river, like moss, robes herself slowly through the cold township of York, more slowly than usual for a cold northern river, you see the citizens indulging stately pleasures like swans, but they seem cold. Why have they been so punished? In what do their sins consist now? An assertion persistent as a gross tumor, and the sense of such growth haunting the flesh of York, is that there has been no synagogue since 1190, when 800 Jews took each other's lives to escape Christian death by Christian hand, and the last took his own. The event has the frigid persistence of a growth in the flesh. It is a fact. No other fact can be added to, save that it was Easter, the time when the dead Christian God rose again. It is in this, perhaps, they are haunted. For the cold blood of victims is colder, more staining, more corrosive in the soul than the blood of martyrs. What consciousness is there of the cold heart when it spaces? For nothing penetrates more than admitted absence. The heart in warmth, even, cannot close its gaps. Absence of Jews through hatred or indifference. A gap they slip through, a conscience that corrodes more deeply since it is forgotten. This deadens York. Where are the stonemasons, the builders skilled in glass, strong first in wood, taut, flaxen plumbers with lengths of pipe, steel rules coiled in their palms, the printers, canopy makers, makers in the institution of marriage? The absence is endless, a socket where the jaw is protected neither through its tolerance for tooth nor for blood. Either there is pain or no pain. If they could feel, were there one among them with this kind of sensitivity that could touch the dignity, masonry of the cold, northern face that falls as you touch it, there might be some moving to a northern expurgation. All Europe is touched with some of frigid York, as York is now by Europe. I've written a poem about the bomb. It was obligatory for poems to be written by poets about the bomb at that time. And it sounds as unhappy about writing it. That's not true. And in the 60s, the government, it was then a conservative government, very different government from the conservative, or perhaps I should say Tory government we have now in Britain. Not unlike, there are certainly similarities between the government that you have in the United States now and the government that we have in Britain now. I mean, I don't want to get political, I'm only a poet, but I'd just like to note that there are resemblances. Yes, that's right. Well, that's unlikely, actually. Anyhow, the government at that time was sending out ladies from the Home Office, whose patriotism had somehow inexplicably survived the Second World War, to tell the women of England what they should do, not if, but when the bomb was dropped. And you notice that little equivocation, not if. The assumption was that it would be dropped, and that, of course, since that was the assumption, it was all right for us to have the bomb and drop it on them too, whoever them would be, turn out to be, I should say. And what these ladies did was to go around the country lecturing, as I say, to the women of England, telling them what they should do, as it were, the prophylactics of defense. And I had at that time a friend who was a nurse who attended one of these lectures, compulsory, I may say, and she told me the gist of what this lady said in her lecture, and I've incorporated it into the first half of my poem. The poem is called Defense. It is dedicated to Anne, and it is prefaced with a little couplet, a sort of Lysistrata-like couplet, which runs, what one in five can do, no man can quite do. Because the lectures were aimed at reaching one in five women throughout the country, the lectures became to be known as One in Five. As for Lysistrata, you remember that this lady was a woman of Athens who, along with most of the other women of Athens, apparently was a bit irritated with their men going off to war and either not coming back or else coming back mutilated. So they held a strike, which was apparently 100% successful, which said that the women would not sleep with their menfolk until they promised not to go to war again. And the she in the poem, in my poem, is the lady from the Home Office. She arrived late with this motto: time used in reconnaissance is not time lost. Useful hint on how efficient our defenses would be. Sent from the Home Office on work of some importance. And the first thing she said is that there will be some preparation before the thing is dropped. You should instruct persons to stand in the center of what room they like, for the blast, unlike the bombs of the previous war, will draw the walls out. There will be no crushing of flesh. Instead, on all sides, walls will reveal the citizen unharmed. Here, a question. But no, she said, we have from our intelligence absolute assurance our capital is not targeted. Total warfare by arrangement. And she was sure when pressed. But there will be devastation, as we now suspect, in radius of 44 miles. The water will be infected. The light from the thing astonishing, which though surprised by, we should not look at. But shelter behind some object to reduce damage to the tissue from radiation, or shelter under brown paper, or, if you can, sheet soaked in urine. So women who crotchet, stop that. Men laboring whose issue is the two-handed house, set that aside. Girls big and delicate with child, turn on your side. You will melt. The raveling spider and the scorpion whose prongs itch will fuse in a viscoid tar, black as a huge fly. The whole of nature is a preying upon. Let man, whose mind is large, legislate for all passionate things, all sensate things. The sensuous grass, whose speech is all in its sharp, bending blade. Leave not a leaf, a stone that rested on the dead, to its own dissolution. She left then, as if with her feet turning an enormous, if man-made, pearl as means of locomotion. Also from my first book is a poem about the death of my first son, my first child, who died in a mental hospital when he was almost a year old. His name was Adam. And there's a lot to say about the poem, but it's not that I'm being coy. I don't really want to spend the time talking too much about it. I think the thing I ought to say is that the poem was written immediately after Adam's death, that there are other poems which I've never republished, although I published them in magazines, which were about Adam and about the nature of madness. And Adam was what they called a defective, mentally defective. It was, in as much as I can say, with a poem that was written so soon after his death, that is to say, immediately after his death. Indeed, the last line of the poem went through my head as he was dying, though I didn't know he was dying, if you see what I mean. He was doing things, these huge tears fell out of his eyes. He was doing this, and since I'd never seen anybody die before, I didn't know whether that was death or not. Or perhaps I didn't want to know whether it was death or not. Perhaps that's the point, really. But even though the poem was written, as I say, immediately after when we got home from the hospital, I think what I was trying to do in the poem, whether I succeeded is another matter, was to try and argue with people like my mother, for instance, who because she was so shocked and hurt by the whole business, said in an unguarded movement that she thought that Adam should never have been born, which implied that Adam had no value. And I think the point about this poem for me was that I was trying to put into the poem the value that I undoubtedly felt Adam undoubtedly had. Anyhow, the poem is called Death of a Son Who Died in a Mental Hospital, Aged One. Something has ceased to come along with me, something like a person, something very like one, and there was no nobility in it or anything like that. Something was there like a one-year-old house, dumb, while the near buildings sang like birds and laughed, understanding the pact they were to have with silence. But he neither sang nor laughed. He did not bless silence like bread with words. He did not forsake silence. But rather, like a house in mourning, kept the eye turned in to watch the silence, while the other houses, like birds, sang around him. And the breathing silence neither moved nor was still. I have seen stones, I have seen brick, but this house was made up of neither bricks nor stone, but a house of flesh and blood, with flesh of stone and bricks for blood. A house of stones and blood in breathing silence, with the other birds singing crazy on its chimneys. But this was silence. This was something else. This was hearing and speaking, though he was a house drawn into silence. This was something religious in his silence, something shining in his quiet. This was different. This was altogether something else. Though he never spoke, this was something to do with death. And then slowly the eyes stopped looking inward. The silence rose and became still. The look turned to the outer place and stopped, with the birds still shrilling around him. And as if he could speak, he turned over on his side with his one ear red as a wound. He turned over as if he could be sorry for this. And out of his eyes, two great tears rolled like stones, and he died. I've gone on writing poems about Adam. It very often suggested to me that the writing of the poem was in some sense a catharsis, a release, and a relief from the pressure of that death. That may be true. I have no way of knowing. I certainly was not conscious of being motivated to write the poem for those reasons. And indeed, I can only say that the writing of the poem etched that event or sharply into my mind. It did not provide any relief. And indeed, I think that's probably right. There are no shortcuts to grief. I wouldn't have thought so. And the poem, in any case, as I perhaps rather heavily and painstakingly tried to suggest, is not a poem about my grief. The grief, if it is there in the poem, is incidental to it. But then I was reading that poem. I do quite a lot of readings in schools in England, and at the end of it, a young girl said, "That's fine," she said, "what about the mother?" Well, that's perfectly true. The mother is not in that poem. But I had, in fact, got round eventually to writing, as I say, several poems about Adam, and this was another one of them, part of a longer poem called. And the poem opens with something that simply did happen. As we were entering the grounds of this mental hospital where Adam was, the grounds were filled with the mad people. It seemed that it was tremendously crowded. And as we were walking along, there was this woman, I don't know how old she was, she had breasts, but her face was had no determinate age. And she came up to us, and then she took hold of my hand very gently and kissed it, raised it to her lips slowly, kissed it, released me courteously and left. In other words, she wanted to give love. And she saw no reason for not doing so. Of course, that raised rather ticklish questions, you know, if that is how the mad are, then perhaps we need more people like that. And which side is one of that division between mad and the allegedly sane, and so on and so on. All the questions that I think we probably all ask ourselves, which are not easy to answer, I don't think. Anyhow, here it is in this poem. Air that pricks earth with life and turns as it returns to darken in the year's midnight, thins in a chill distraction. Winter's sun burns a low arc through the horizon and is absent. As we trudge the area where our child is lying, this soil is trodden by the mad, who, at the next spring, but that is at the next world, may, with its flexible sense, allied by that stark light, the vacancies in their maimed circuits. If no world unfolds, these dead may rise to. If our half-buds a flesh that does not know itself and does not open in a separate flowering and touches signs which touch without a trace of healing correspondence, in this world will have to do. She who drifts with her group of friends, as if we beckoned, leaves and is behind us both. Her shape bends gently down. Her large, quiet hands, her breasts hardly there, an independent mildness at the mouth, branched past the cheekbones, brushes to the eyes, widening in hunger. She gazes and lifts my hand up slowly to her lips, then, kissing it, releases me with care, gently, and leaves. That gentleness forming without submission as she kisses my hand bravely. Who shared in that kiss? In which instant, sane or defective? Shame at my dividing question. Walk a bit onto the ward. Out of its souring brick, bird-like, the mad alight, shake and fold in their movements to their bodies, gazing queerly or quiver in recognition, timid but pressing on us to touch us over our hands or faces or touch us with their eyes, while everywhere their mild, untrained gaze forms the unsure part in creaturely connection. And as I feel her hand, earlier forms shed their flesh, leaving this bare. 12 almost, to test my sanity, I squatted on the pavement and put a marble on my tongue, closing my mouth on it. If I could swallow this and die, I was insane. Or if I left it balancing on my tongue, then I'm mad to do this. Our child for them is mad. We reach the twilight ward. Adam lies in a bed as if an adult. Through his face, his blood, making the skin chill, dampening it, stirs. He breathes, yielding a changed breath. We labor it and press it, the lungs that can't be relieved, letting it from them. She rises, and slowly as she brings her mouth to him, her lips widen. lightly and light, as if she were withdrawing as she sinks beside his silence breathing. She lifts up his head and lightly kisses the eyelids, his mouth then, as she puts her finger to his palm, turning his head to us. The eyes, eyes that are firm, breath in a changing form moves through them, flickering softness in its shape. Over and not obscuring that, the moisture of his body, swelling the eyes and widening them, brings the life that concentrates, searching itself to grow connections in him. Forming him, formed and held like this, it connected us to him, holding us until that moisture pressed with a thick movement from him. I wrote a number of poems about flowers, wildflowers mainly, when I was living in Leeds, and I'd just like to read two of them. They didn't start off as a group. What happened was that I'd let the garden that I was living in, it was a university flat, and it was very productive, the flat. It grew well outside and grew an enormous amount of fungus inside as well, but I'd never get the university to clean it up. And besides which, I was writing poetry. I had much more important things to do, of course. And so I let the garden go as well. And the grass got enormously long, and as I would walk through it, little frogs would leap up. And then I had a fit of bourgeois conscience, and I thought I ought to try and do something about what had once been a lawn. So I started to try and pull the dandelions up. But as you know, if you don't fork around the roots, you might just as well forget it, because they just break off at ground level. And that's it. So, and they just grow fine. So what I did on this occasion, after I'd unsuccessfully pulled the dandelions up, I had noticed this time that the plant exuded this thick, viscous, milky fluid, which is like the plant's blown up after that. And I wrote a poem about dandelions shortly after that. And then I perceived that the garden was full not only of flowers but also potential poems. So I started to write poems about the flowers in the garden. And I tried to describe as accurately as I could what I saw. And then came the obvious problem of anthropomorphizing, that really you can't help but be saying something about the human creature while ostensibly saying something about other creatures. So I decided that perhaps the best strategy would be to be frankly anthropomorphic, so that with one eye I try to describe what the flower looked like, and with the other to try and visualize a human type or human situation which paralleled the creature that I was looking at. Well, I'll read a couple of these poems. This poem is called The Violet, and it's about courage, which I think is a commodity that is in fairly short supply, I should know. The lobed petals receive each other's nestling shape. We share the sun's beneficence, frost, men, snowdrops. Then the violet unfolds, not an uncasing of the corolla, each petal compliant to the purpose of survival, obedient to that. But as it feels the sun's heat, that puberty pushes out from its earlier self-clasping two distinct, clenched halves, stiffens them. These fluttering portions that made the bud separately elect to be the flower. The violet halves itself, pushing apart in separate forces. It divides up itself. It becomes two violet portions. There is not a conformation of members, each petal, a tooth, an eyelash. On the other hand, the violet is torn apart. It increases by dividing. Its stiffened petals push further apart. It adheres to its nature. It has no maturity other than this. It requires courage and finds that in this unclasping of its self-worship. Two palms tentatively open. Going both ways, they absorb a huge circle of violeted air, an intent movement of embrace, created, exposed, powerful. The air is colored somewhat violet. It costs itself much. One more of these poems. This is called Harebell, which is a flower that looks like from an angle poise lamp. I don't know whether you have it in Arizona. Looking at the vegetation in your desert, I would be very surprised if the harebell could manage to get this far south. In Scotland, it's called the bluebell, but that shouldn't confuse you. And what I admired about this little plant was its reticence. I had in mind, you know, Hazlitt, the 19th century critic, could never forgive Wordsworth for changing political sides. And in the spirit of the age, he wrote of Wordsworth, "If Mr. Wordsworth is garrulous now, it was not his wont." Well, fancy having that said about you when you were alive. Fancy that surviving your death. And indeed, I suppose if one were true to one's words, one would not write more poems. But it's the spareness of this flower, its spare beauty, that I like enormously. I mean, poets are permitted to write about flowers as well, aren't they? As I was leaving the restaurant, there were a couple of five guys, about five large guys, and they'd heard that I was English because the people with us had said, "When are you going back to England?" And as I passed, they said, "Doesn't speak like one." And then there was a pause and they said, "He doesn't smell like one either." The harebell is one flower, its solitariness bespoke by its color, not blue nor violet, hovering between precisely. It is a spare bell. Inside it are three pale sugary stigmas welded to each other at equal angles, not seen until looked for. Its stem is thin as wire. The flower looks down, and if lifted, looks fixedly at the admirer. Its silence halted between primness and beauty, its shape is wrung from the sounds of life round it, as a bell's sound forms the bell shape from silence and resumes its demure integrity. More precise, more shaped than the bluebell, more venturesome, more stirred, ungarrulous, stern as a pin. In 1965, I moved further north again from Leeds to the city of Newcastle. And again, something occurred through the auspices of a different Conservative government. And that was what was called the Industrial Relations Bill, which sought, you must surely have been seeing something about the long miners' strike in England. Well, that Conservative government sought at that time not to prohibit, but to inhibit strike action. And incidentally, what I have just said, whenever I read some of the poems that I'm going to read now, for example, on television, my commentary was cut out because the television people feared to be actually taken to task by the government and even sued for supporting a political view which was antipathetic to their own. We do have democracy, that is, we elect our leader. Here's a poem my my wife and I were wandering around Northumberland, and we came across one of the many railroad tracks that have been pulled up in Britain. I mean, you're aware of this phenomenon in your own country, aren't you? The disemployment of certain ways of getting about the country. In England, it matters a great deal more, and indeed, I think you would be surprised to find how remote quite a number of our rural communities are. Because what then happens is that the buses are withdrawn, and then if you don't have a car, you're really in difficulties. And that's basically the fate of the county north of Newcastle, where we live, Northumberland, which is the last county you pass through before entering Scotland on the east side of England. The city that I live in, the Carrying Coals, is the last major city on the east side of England before you get to Scotland. So it's Newcastle, Berwick, Edinburgh, that little route. Anyhow, we were going on one of the three roads from Newcastle to Edinburgh, and there we spotted a disused railway line, and then the little station and some railwaymen's cottages. And we were wandering along the station, out comes this guy, and he starts to talk. He said, "Yes, I worked on this line. It's Newcastle, Berwick, Edinburgh, that little route." Anyhow, we were going on one of the three roads from Newcastle to Edinburgh, and there we spotted a disused railway line, and then the little station and some railwaymen's cottages. And we were wandering along the station, out comes this guy, and he starts to talk. He said, "Yes, I worked on this line for 50 years, and my friend and I used to gang, that is to say, to look after a section of this line, about 8 miles of it. And 50 years ago, I helped to build this track, but you can't see it anymore, of course," and so on and so on. And gradually, what I realized was that he was talking about the destruction of his adult working life. Not complaining about it, simply talking about it. And I thought that I wanted to write about it. And there was something else that was very odd. He said, "My friend," this friend with whom he worked, ganging the railway line, "my friend's in a home now." And the way he went on to talk about him made me feel that what he was saying very delicately was that his friend was in a mental institution, from which I surmised that perhaps what happened was this, that faced with the destruction of your adult life, you either bear or break. And the man we were talking to, whom we went to see again quite a few times, he's dead now, did survive that destruction, but his friend didn't. And that accounts for the end of the poem, where his friend writes to him, and he says, "Why are you writing to me? Who are you? What do you want?" I've actually cribbed this, the words, because in the 19th century there was another agricultural working man who was also a poet called John Clare, who went mad, yes, and was incarcerated in the Northampton Mental Institution. And John Clare was intermittently mad, or intermittently sane, according to where you stand. And in one of the letters he writes, "Dear Sir, I am mad." I suppose that was when he wasn't mad. And then he concludes, and then he says, "And so I conclude your obedient servant, John Clare." Well, I've used a portion of that letter, and I'll try and, with an alteration in my voice, convey that it's Middlemass's friend replying to Middlemass from the asylum. The poem is called Plate Layer, and Middlemass does most of the speaking in the poem. "I did not serve, but was skilled for 50 years, laying plates measured as carefully apart as seedlings. The line came west from Morpeth, crossing the third road for Scotland. At Nosegate," which is the little village he lived in, "at Nosegate, four houses group on a bank set away. A station was built there. I laid plates for 8 miles, but short of Morpeth, sledging chucks that held the rails kept them so, although this has gone now. Yet here are 4 pines of the 5 I put in, and here I helped to concrete that was the day. My dog has 16 years. We both suffer the heat. And yet her owners had said that she must be put down. I did not say that. And the Lupins strike through the platform. With a better chance, I think, they'd have not done well. But what I think is that my work was finished up. 5 years past, the track taken apart. No, not so. Now we've cranes to hoist the length that we laid down, form on form. Also gone, a certain friend who finished when I was made free. I shan't work any job twice. And this is strange, having the letter from the man, although it was not him. Yet surely as like him as the bolts drove in. I can't think of your name or what you are. You must excuse me, and I have nothing to tell you, and why I am shut up here, I can't speak of with nothing to speak about. But still I am certain the track we built was skilled, although you can't tell that. If I read three more, would that be... Is that all right? And then I'll stop. I'll read a poem that I think is a difficult poem. Well, maybe they're all difficult. I don't know. And this is a poem that attempts to braid together two narratives. The narratives are very different. One is about when I came out of the army. Before actually getting a labouring job, I was on the streets and actually managed to starve very efficiently and landed up with malnutrition. I merely mention this because although we do have a welfare state in England, there are people within the welfare state, which Maggie the Thatcher's busy destroying, who nevertheless starve whether or not she destroys it or not. I was lucky. I always knew that I would get on my feet. But walking down Great Peter Street, which is where the hostel was that I was staying at, the Salvation Army hostel, and there was a dustbin there, and the guy reached there first and decided that he didn't like the contents very much of the dustbin, so he left them, and I got there and I agreed with him. But the point of the story is surely that the man that I was looking at would probably never be able to quit his poverty, or so it seemed to me. I think that was what stood out most of all in that experience. Anyhow, there was one strand of the narrative that is about that, and about my failure as a human being within that context. And the other is about my loving another human being. The English language, English and American languages have two words which overlap, which express the disjunction of the two narratives in this poem. And one of the words is compassion, and the other is passion. And they do overlap, but they don't overlap a great deal. And I think what I'm trying to say is that the poem is about the impossibility of bringing those two strands of love together in any meaningful way. Which doesn't mean we don't try. One comes back to Hebrew prophecy again, you know, never, but that doesn't mean we don't try. And I couldn't find a title for this poem, so as you can see, it's a bit difficult. So I called it Untitled Poem. I see that the narratives braid in and out of each other, so I move from one to the other. The perfume on your body and the musk of it. The second is on me. I smell the first on you as a sign. I wear the undelicate odor. Shuffling through the city, my mildness deceit, hungry and light-headed with venom. The adder silks to refuse bins. Fastened to the street, the working men's hostel passed two bins. A man beat me to those. I was afraid, and the pulps he left stayed unfingered. I had not thought of you. Timidly, I spent my pence. In a dormitory, my body covered my trousers. Along your flesh drifts your hair, a tree bearing concupiscence, and your smile shows. This is enough, almost. Arms are slim, your fingers amazing strength. The tree's whole self blurts through long hair. It's not grief, not joy. Saffron spills milk on the road. A friend working through television gave me a brass threepence. I bought tea with it, bearing Nursia. In Jerusalem, the hills bear. Soft-haired goats made of teeth, all the shoots are champed. Hunger drifts through plains over the declivities of London, delicate, smoky flakes of it. On the rock splinters cold air. A coward felt another's bruises in his groin. He fears the cold air, its true match. Love, I love you. Can I mean more? You smile among four friends, three of us speak, and you say nothing. It's your speech is a silent woman. Each night the kicked man screams, if I help you, if I can lift you. His stain over stone is blue, feather light. The feet of police emboss the sidewalk. Linked by my penis, our child could grow. Fear synchronizes with us. I enter you, local as a root. I wait for you to get your breath. We measure each other. We are prepared. Lassitude melts. The hair is naked. The piled spaces of hunger. And I touch our candor. The flesh in abandoned robes gently the tenderness. The candle's flame curves round its inner light. Your hair is seaweed. Smile monstrously. Memory flushes me through. Your salt skin rustles on me. Of love, this entirely is not what we were taught. Thin black coffee in a pan flicks beads of heat. The flaking city mounds stillness. And amiable sleep spreads our flesh. We will not last, love, as we are. Love, I would have us stay ever like this. My conscience, my fear, and our sex stir. I'll read, as I say, just two more. In 1980, when I was, I'd done a three-month stint at the University of Louisville, and I was preparing to go back to England, and not altogether looking forward to it. And the poem is called The Ship's Pasture. In the sun, the leaf, hesitant but active, this fluorescence of plain wood. With joy, I saw the fields of England as new, chartered shapes, bargained for, and so snipped with standing sheep, their snowy garments by the limestone walls, bulbous fossils, their thick, inert forms, braids dangling the soft wealth of England. Salah. Except, some people here are brutal. The fist, because of standing in the wrong place at the cheekbone. Fist. A snide, arrowy word. I rose from England much refreshed, but returned at evening, much undone that was once good prior to this mean juncture. It was joy beside myself to see the new fields. Whose is this land that, like waiting flesh, turns with a kiss, domestic, but yet is a local habitation with no substance or name sustaining it. It is the ship's pasture, its interlinking husk of submarine, sea spike, the sleeted fields of destruction, for payment, for emolument. I am a part of this, the bee, cutter of wood, whose timbered house is unimaginably hospitable. This is what it is. Northwards, O Jerusalem, with the lamb, lies separate, its shade dense and lovely. The woman starts again, as though each portion of this were knit afresh. Now, read one more poem that I read last night to a group of Steve Olin's writing class. It's the area that I mentioned, Jesmond, and this is the last poem, is an area very near, more or less absorbed by the center of Newcastle now, an area of that is mainly composed of urban bourgeoisie, of which I am one. And it's about the caring for children, really. That's what it's about, I think. And I mention also a Russian writer here, a writer called Zamyatin, who during the First World War worked in Newcastle and lived in Jesmond. He was supervising the construction of icebreakers for the Tsar on Tyneside, which is one of the traditional industries of Newcastle, that and coal mining, neither of which survive with much profit now. The poem is called The Achievers, and the story that Zamyatin satirized the Jesmond folk in is a story called The Islanders. Behind a front door, stairs without turn or landing run to a back attic in one flight. Breathing go diagonally as if hand in hand through the house. Red stair carpet and hump, separating two walls that build like stanchions of light into the roof. This is Jesmond, Zamyatin made in his Islanders a Russian jest of, shifting the tedium of yards as he oversaw the construction and constitution of Russian ships. 1916, the pole of the year, it's ice, a dithering of ocean, the Tsar's icebreakers furrow dark water. In a front room, siding the stairs, a boy fingers a flute, and a young woman, circumscribed in a circle of light, shed from a lamp like a green bonnet, stands a little to the side, back a bit, and bends above him to read the notes, their closed dots and fins silently filling the page, as stairs fill the house, climbing a magnitude of soft despair and achievement. Thanks.